The Outpost Radio on Demand. Here's Art Young from the Outpost Magazine.
This time on the Outpost on Demand, we're talking to the author of a new book called Trout Culture. Hi, my name is Art Young, and I'm the editor of the Outpost Magazine. I've always been fascinated by how the unintended consequences of some man-made manipulation of nature can wreak havoc later. Such is the case with trout culture in the Rocky Mountain area. And the woman who has done an amazing job of researching and presenting the story of how fly fishing forever changed the Rocky Mountains West is Jen Corinne Brown. Welcome, Jen.
Hi, Art.
Why does a professor of history decide to write about fly fishing?
Good question. Well, I love fly fishing, and I'm very much interested in Western history and environmental history, and so the two just kind of come together. Both are my passions, and I found a way to combine it.
Well, you did a great job. This is one of those books where if you're a conservationist, you should definitely run, don't walk, to get this book called Trout Culture. Give us a brief overview, kind of the elevator pitch of your observations about trout culture.
The book itself is really about how the Rocky Mountains became known for fly fishing and trout. And in narrating this history, I'm talking about vast manipulations of the environment, of introductions of non-native species, stocking of billions and billions of hatchery fish, and then the consequences of that all. And on one hand, the consequences are great. The Rocky Mountain trout fishing is amazing. It's a great place to go and fish. On the other hand, what it's done is caused massive native fish declines. Of the 14 subspecies of cutthroat trout in the West are between habitat destruction and the introductions of non-native trout, most of them are either extinct, endangered, threatened in some form or the other. And so my history is the development of both the kind of hatchery side of the history, but then also how Rocky Mountain anglers develop an entirely new kind of fly fishing culture that is very much Western.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, around the turn of the 19th century, based on your research, fly fishing, or fishing in general, changed from being something that was more subsistence and turned in kind of a leisure activity. Why did this happen?
Well, it had to do with larger changes to the economy. And as the American kind of industry grew in the late 19th century, you had the rise of an entirely new middle class that was growing and growing. And in response, ironically, to the industrialization, to crowding in the cities and this kind of new work world where people are laboring in the factories or overseeing the factories, there's this massive need for escape. And with that, you have the rise of leisure activities, the rise of sport for middle classes. One of those is angling, but angling and fly fishing, ironically, it's not precisely just the sport. It's always for subsistence. It's for kind of eating the food as well. And so the rise of angling, it had always been around, but in the late 19th century, becomes even more popular as a leisure activity.
Mm-hmm. And what effect did the Industrial Revolution have on fishing from a gear standpoint?
Well, from a gear standpoint, what you have is a revolution, honestly, of what gear could be used. Because ironically, even though this was a movement of getting back to nature and getting out on rivers, the gear of the late 19th century, for fly fishing anyway, was only made possible through those industrial techniques. So you have the rise of bamboo fly rods, which could only be made into excellent fishing instruments through kind of modern machinery. And you have the rise of silk lines and exotic feathers from parts across the world that were brought closer together with kind of steamships and railroads and the industry of the world at that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they haven't changed much since then, have they?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, bamboo's kind of making a comeback as a throwback fly fishing gear, but generally the standards for fishing reels and fly rods, well, the materials change and we have a vast array of kind of synthetic materials, it's basically the same form it was 100 years ago or 150 years ago.
Yeah, that's astounding to me. I mean, anyone who fishes, especially for trout, and especially in the Rocky Mountains area, is aware of the concept of catch and release. You catch them, you have the fun of catching them, and then you put them back in the water. Mm-hmm. When did this practice start, and why did it start?
Well, that's a complicated question.
I'm a complicated guy, Jim. I'm a complicated guy.
Well, I think that fly fishing, really catch and release fly fishing, it's always been around. You read the early English treatise on fishing, and they're talking about releasing fish back into the river, making sure there's sport for the next year. And this gets brought from Europe to the United States with settlement. In the West, catch and release becomes really big from about the 1930s to the 1950s, when you see the rise of a fishing culture in the West. And you had people like Lee Wolf writing about a game fish is too valuable to only be caught once, and other writers, guides, outfitters who realized in the West that the key to both their sport, but then also this growing economy, was to conserve it for future generations. Catch and release in the West becomes ingrained into kind of the fly fishing aesthetic. But it also has more, I guess you could say, more, what's the word I'm looking for here? I hope you can edit this.
I think it's. I mean, it kind of leans toward elitism, doesn't it?
Well, I don't know, because it also has more practical considerations in that the 150-year mining and industrial economies in the West have led to lead, mercury, and heavy metals in many of the waters that could hold fish. And so there's the practical consideration of you don't want to eat too many of the fish because you're also ingesting the mercury and the lead and everything else from gold mining, copper mining, silver mining.
Yeah, that's a long way from Native Americans using nets and dynamite. And I mean, I read one part of your book. Did people actually poison fish to catch them? What was that all about?
Yeah, that was a native fishing method across the world of using various plants and berries, putting them in the water, and it works as a fish toxicant where it would kill the fish, they'd float to the top, and then you could harvest the fish that way. So that was a native fishing method that was kind of incorporated into modern fisheries management by the mid-20th century, of taking those toxicants, refining them in an industrial way, and then making fish toxicants to use for fisheries management of getting rid of unwanted species.
The trash fish, or whatever they're called, whatever you call them. What was your term you used in your book about the
coarse fish?
Yeah, coarse fish. That's right. That's right. Now, are most trout found in the Rocky Mountains native? I mean, and why should we care whether they're native or not?
Well, no, most of the kind of well-known trout fisheries of the West are non-native species. Rainbow trout, brook trout, brown trout all come from east or west coasts of North America or from Europe, and a variety of other trout species that were introduced. So most of the, when we think of trout fishing in the West, ironically, they're all non-native fisheries. But what that's done is that it's created this kind of moment in time where more and more anglers and fisheries managers are concerned about these non-native or native species, excuse me, cutthroat trout, Arctic grayling, bull trout in some places, and what to do about those declining numbers. Why should we care? Well, I think because as anglers, we have the, I guess you could say we have the responsibility to take care of the places that we enjoy. And what I wrote the book was to give all the kind of context of those current day issues between native and non-native species. It's not necessarily to say we should pick one or the other, but it's more of trying to get people to have these conversations of native versus non-native and what to do with them. Because the West, and in places like Yellowstone National Park, Montana, Utah, Wyoming, a lot of the fisheries management is now using those fish toxicants, the ones that the native fishers of the late 19th century used, but using those toxicants to poison, to dump into a stream, kill off all the fish in it, and then stock them with native species from brood stocks, from kind of state hatcheries. So there's this really weird manipulation going on right now of maybe too much of a focus on those fish toxicants or mm-hmm. native species. Mm-hmm. So I don't really have any answers to present-day issues, but I wanted to kind of provide the background of that. Why did people in the past make those decisions? What were the consequences of those decisions? And then I hope that could create better conversations about decision-making in the future.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I think you've done that beautifully. And I think the, again, I'm fascinated by and often repulsed by the, you know, the theory of unintended consequences. What we're doing today that we think, I mean, a perfect example is kudzu in the, all over the, you know, anybody who lives in the Eastern Americas know that, you know, kudzu is taking over all up and down the East Coast from Georgia to Vermont, and it came about because somebody in a World's Fair from Japan bought this plant over, and someone said, "Oh, that'd be great for my cows," and took it into an area that it was not, you know, that it went crazy, and you know, you got to figure out, oh, how do we get rid of this kudzu now that we have it? So it's very similar to your analysis
or
about
lionfish in the Gulf.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting to me just aesthetically, why are rainbows, for example, more popular than other species?
Well, one is the aspect of what they do when you hook them. And rainbows put up a really good fight. They jump up in the air, and the way they react on the hook is very exciting once you hook them, if you can hook them, way to catch a fish. But they're also very beautiful. There's an element of beauty that plays a role in what species we like and what species we don't like, particularly in the West where you have a lot of trout. And so there's the element of sport, but then there's also, I think, the element of beauty that plays into why we like trout so much.
Mm-hmm. So what's your conclusion about fixing the trout culture of the Rockies? Can it be fixed, or are you just given a background to say, let's talk about these things?
Well, I think that these issues over native and non-native species are going to be more and more of a hot topic in the future. I don't necessarily have any answers at this point, but I think that historically anglers have played an important role in conservation. And you saw this from the 19th century to the present of the role they play in providing kind of the grassroots movement of saving rivers and fish, and not only in the West, but across the United States was very important. But I think that modern fisheries management and and their kind of overly focus on restoring native species and using fish toxicants has the potential to alienate a lot of anglers who are either economically or culturally connected to those non-native trout in the West, because we're talking about billion-dollar industries of tackle and gear and outfitting and tourism in those Western states. And I think this issue, as scientists are becoming kind of concerned over preserving biodiversity, is going to create more problems over conservation and fishing in the West.
Trout Culture, by our guest today, Jen Brown, is available at your local bookstore probably. And if you don't have a local bookstore, which is kind of sad, most of us don't anymore, you can get it on Amazon.com. Jen, this is a fascinating book, and I want to thank you for putting so much work and doing such a great job on it.
All right. Thanks for having me on, Art.
Absolutely. I'm Art Young. I'm the editor of The Outpost Magazine, and we'll talk again soon.
The Outpost Radio On Demand, from the on-demand page of theoutpostlife.com.